Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Okay. Shifting a little bit further into the mind, moving from Vedana into contemplation of the mind itself, although Vedana is definitely part of that as well, thought I'd read the classic tonight, the Madhupindaka Sutta, which is translated as the Honeyball, Majjhima number 18, and a few commentaries on it as well, or a few small thoughts on it from Ajahn Jeff and from Bhante and Alayo. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living in the Sakyan country at Kapilavatthu in Nigrodha's park. Then, when it was morning, the Blessed One dressed, and taking his bowl and outer robe, went into Kapilavatthu for alms. When he had wandered for alms in Kapilavatthu and had returned from his alms round, after his meal he went to the great wood for the day's abiding, and entering the great wood, sat down at the root of a bilva sapling for the day's abiding. Dandapani, the Sakyan, while walking and wandering for exercise, also went to the great wood. Dandapani translates as stick in hand. So he was known for the staff that he carried, and according to the footnote, he wasn't old or disabled. He was young and ostentatious. And when he had entered the great wood, he went to the bilva sapling where the Blessed One was and exchanged greetings with him. When this courteous and amiable talk had finished, he stood at one side, leaning on his stick, and asked the Blessed One, "What does the recluse assert? What does he proclaim?" Let me just read the footnote on that. According to the commentaries, Dandapani also sided with Devadatta, the Buddha's arch foe, the Buddha's cousin, when the latter attempted to create a schism in the Buddha's following. Dandapani's manner of asking the question is arrogant and deliberately provocative, in case you didn't pick that up. What does the recluse assert? What does he proclaim? "Friend, I assert and proclaim my teaching in such a way that one does not quarrel with anyone in the world with its gods, its maras, and its brahmas, in this generation with its recluses and brahmins, its princes and its people, in such a way that perceptions no more underlie that brahman who abides detached from sensual pleasures without perplexity, shorn of worry, free from craving for any kind of being." And I'll probably be reading a few of the footnotes through this. The first part of the Buddha's reply directly counters Dandapani's aggressive attitude. Commentary quotes in this connection from Samyutta Nikaya, 2294, "Bhikkhus, I do not dispute with the world, it is the world that disputes with me. A speaker of Dhamma does not dispute with anyone in the world." The second part of this part that I just read from the Honeyball Sutta the second part may be taken to mean that for the arahant, spoken of here as that Brahman with reference to the Buddha himself, perceptions no longer awaken the dormant underlying tendencies to defilements. So once again, the way that it was written in the sutta that one does not, in such a way, he proclaims his teaching in such a way that one does not quarrel with anyone in the world in such a way that perceptions no more underlie that Brahman who abides detached from sensual pleasures, without perplexity, shorn of worry, free from craving of any kind of being, and again meaning that perceptions no longer awaken those dormant underlying tendencies. Okay. When this was said, Dandapani the Sakyan shook his head, wagged his tongue, and raised his eyebrows until his forehead was puckered in three lines. I'd like to see that. Then he departed, leaning on his stick. I think that means he was frustrated and confused. Then when it was evening, the Blessed One rose from meditation and went to Nigrodha's park, where he sat down on a seat made ready for him, and told the bhikkhus what had taken place. Then a certain bhikkhu asked the Blessed One, "But, Venerable Sir, how does the Blessed One ascertain proclaim his teaching in such a way that he does not quarrel with anyone in the world, with its gods, its maras, its brahmas, in this generation with its recluses and brahmins, its princes and its people? And, Venerable Sir, how is it that perceptions no more underlie the Blessed One, that Brahman who abides detached from sensual pleasures, without perplexity, shorn of worry, freed from craving for any kind of being?" Bhikkhu, as to the source through which perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a man, if nothing is found there to delight in, welcome, and hold to, this is the end of the underlying tendency to lust, of the underlying tendency to aversion, of the underlying tendency to views, of the underlying tendency to doubt, of the underlying tendency to conceit, of the underlying tendency to desire for being, of the underlying tendency to ignorance. This is the end of resorting to rods and weapons, of quarrels, brawls, disputes, recrimination, malicious words, and false speech. Here these evil, unwholesome states cease without remainder. So there's a very long footnote about this paragraph, particularly the line, as to the source through which perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a man. So this is mental proliferation is the translation that Bhikkhu Bodhi uses for papancha. There's a number of other... There's been a lot of scholarly discussion about what papancha is, how it's best described, what it actually means. Ajahn Jeff uses the word objectification, I'll a little bit further down when this gets explored a little bit more, I'll read some commentary from Ajahn Jeff around that particular use of the word objectification. But for now, I'll just say that one more time. Bhikkhu, as to the source through which perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a man, if nothing is found there to delight in, welcome, and hold to, this is the end of all of the underlying tendencies. This is what the Blessed One said. Having said this, the Sublime One rose from his seat and went into his dwelling. Then, soon after the Blessed One had gone, the bhikkhus considered, "Now, friends, the Blessed One has risen from his seat and gone into his dwelling after giving a summary in brief without expounding the detailed meaning. Now, who will expound this in detail?" Then they considered, "The Venerable Mahakachana is praised by the teacher and esteemed by his wise companions in the holy life. He is capable of expounding the detailed meaning. Suppose we went to him and asked him the meaning of this." Then the bhikkhus went to the Venerable Mahakachana and exchanged greetings with him. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, they sat down to one side and told him what had taken place, adding, "Let the Venerable Mahakachana expound it to us." The Venerable Mahakachana replied, "Friends, it is as though a man needing heartwood, seeking heartwood, wandering in search of heartwood, thought that heartwood should be sought for among the branches and leaves of a great tree standing possessed of heartwood, after he had passed over the root and the trunk. And so it is with you, Venerable Sirs, that you think that I should be asked about the meaning of this after you passed the Blessed One by when you were face to face with the teacher. For knowing, the Blessed One knows. Seeing, he sees. He is vision, he is knowledge, he is the Dhamma. He is the Holy One. He is the Sayer, the Proclaimer, the Elucidator of Meaning, the Giver of the Deathless, the Lord of the Dhamma, the Tathagata. That was the time when you should have asked the Blessed One the meaning. As he told you, so you should have remembered it. Surely, friend Kochana, knowing the Blessed One knows, seeing he sees, he is vision, etc., the Tathagata. That was the time when we should have asked the Blessed One the meaning. As he told us, so we should have remembered it. Yet the Venerable Mahakachana is praised by the teacher and esteemed by his wise companions in the holy life. The Venerable Mahakachana is capable of expounding the detailed meaning of this summary given in brief by the Blessed One without expounding the detailed meaning. Let the Venerable Mahakachana expound it without finding it troublesome. Then listen, friends, and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, friend, the bhikkhus replied. The Venerable Mahakachana said this. Friends, when the Blessed One rose from his seat and went into his dwelling after giving a summary in brief without expounding the detailed meaning, that is, bhikkhu, as to the source through which perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a man, if nothing is found there to delight in, welcome, and hold to, this is the end of the underlying tendency to lust and all of the other underlying states. Here these evil, unwholesome states cease without remainder. I understand the detailed meaning of it to be as follows. Dependent on the eye and forms, eye consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is contact. With contact as condition, there is feeling. What one feels, that one perceives. What one perceives, that one thinks about. What one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates. With what one has mentally proliferated as the source, perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a man with respect to past, future, and present forms cognizable through the eye. And I'm going to pause there for a moment. That's sort of the key phrase that then gets repeated with all the other sense bases, which I'll go through in a minute. But I'm going to take that one paragraph and read it again and then read some commentary on it. Depend on the eye and forms, eye consciousness arises. The meaning of the three is contact. With contact as condition, there is feeling. What one feels, that one perceives. What one perceives, that one thinks about. What one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates. With what one has mentally proliferated as the source, perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a man with respect to past, future, and present forms cognizable through the eye. So Ajahn Jeff has some comments about this sutta and this word, papancha. This is from his book, Skill in Questions. This is on page 69. Papancha is a difficult term to translate. Some common English equivalents for it include objectification, which is Ajahn Jeff's most used word, complication, elaboration, differentiation, and proliferation. In ancient Indian artistic theory, papancha referred to the elaboration of an artwork's basic theme, the process of embodying that theme in specific objects, such as the notes of a musical piece, the colors and forms of a painting, or the words and images of a literary work. The Buddha, however, had his own uses and explanations for the term. Without giving it a formal definition, he cited it functionally in Majjhima 18, which is what we're reading, and Digha Nikaya 21 to describe the sort of thinking that leads to conflict. In the Sutta Nipata 4.14, he identified the root of papancha classifications as the thought, "I am the thinker." Because this thought turns the I, meaning just the letter I, me, I, because this thought turns the I into an object or being, and because the classifications derived from this thought deal with the status of individual objects existing in a world of objects, objectification is probably the best translation for the Buddha's use of the term papancha. The one caveat here is that unlike the modern psychological use of objectification, in which the subject treats other people as objects, objectification in the Buddha's sense begins when the subject objectifies itself. Only then does it apply the same process to others. So as I understand it, you know, what he's saying is that the word objectification he feels is a good one because it's basically this activity of papancha is when the person identifies themselves as the one who is the source of all of this activity and therefore makes oneself an object. So it's not just that there are other objects out in the world that one is relating to, but that one has clearly defined oneself as oneself who is relating to others. So it's a very strong statement of the conceit I am, thinking I am, and thinking that I am the one who is thinking, specifically. So it's a little complicated, and sometimes, you know, sometimes to me the translation mental proliferation actually describes the feeling a little more accurately, but I can see Ajahn Jeff's reason for using the word objectification. And I'll just read one more paragraph and then see if people have any questions for clarification. Moving to page 72 in his book. And he's now referring to the last paragraph I read about the I informs and I consciousness, and then that series of with contact as condition, there is feeling, what one feels, that one perceives, and then one thinks about, and then one mentally proliferates, and then the whole process gets going. The progression in this passage is instructive. At first, the processes of sensory contact are described in impersonal terms. I forms, I consciousness, contact, and feeling. And he says it's described in impersonal forms because he's just saying, dependent on the I informs, I consciousness arises. I-E-Y-E, consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is contact. With contact as condition, there is feeling. Just this progress where there's no relationship or no intimation of a self yet involved. With feeling, however, an agent appears who then feels, perceives, and thinks. So, and this is evident by the phrasing in the book here, or in the teaching. At that point, it says, he says, with contact as condition, there is feeling, and then what one feels, that one perceives. So the I, the self, the sense of self has entered. What one feels, that one perceives. What one perceives, that one thinks about. What one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates. So it's moved from just the sense bases and contact, and it's moved into someone who is feeling, someone who is perceiving, someone who is proliferating. So again, with feeling, however, an agent appears who then feels, perceives, and thinks. This thinking, however, does not yet use the perceptions and categories of objectification, a point that will be important in allowing for the use of thought on the path. The verb for thinking used here, vitaketi, corresponds to the noun vitaka, which appears in the standard definitions of right concentration and noble right resolve. So thinking in itself can be a useful tool. It doesn't necessarily move into papancha. Nevertheless, the agent frequently moves from thinking to objectifying, at which point the role of agent changes to that of victim. Assailed by the perceptions and categories of objectification, entangled in the thicket and fetter of views. So before I go on, any points that don't make sense or need clarification or have thought, any proliferative thoughts about?
Could you just read those last two sentences?
From Ajahn Jeff's?
Thank you. Starting
with the use of the word thinking or?
Thinking.
Okay. The verb for thinking used here, vitakkheti, corresponds to the noun vitakka, which appears in the standard definition of right concentration and noble right resolve. And he's making that point to illustrate that all thinking doesn't necessarily have to move into proliferation, that it can be a skillful endeavor to use thinking skillfully. Nevertheless, the agent frequently moves from thinking to objectifying or proliferating, at which point the role of agent changes to that of victim, assailed by the perceptions and categories of objectification, entangled in the thicket and fetter of views.
I think he's taken, like this is an antagonistic. The other place for Papancha is predominant is in Anguttara Nikaya 8. I believe there's a monastic who goes through the seven qualities of a great man or something?
Yeah, he punches.
Yeah, and then the eighth, and he's proliferating. This is how I read the sutta. He's proliferating all these qualities of a great man. The Buddhist recognizes he's doing this as mine. He goes and sees him and says, you're missing one. One, papancha, over proliferation, of a great man also is nipancha, not proliferating. And this brings this monastic to enlightenment. And I mean, I really read that as
Anuruddha, I believe it is.
Yeah, it's Anuruddha.
Is it?
It's Anuruddha who's thinking.
Uh-huh. Yeah, my sense was that it's not a rebuke, you know. I've never read that as a rebuke. You're thinking too much.
I don't think he's thinking of a rebuke. Oh. Well, I mean, I think he's saying, hey, I felt that he was saying, that was pointing out an instruction. I mean, he realized that this overthinking was not thinking or over proliferating is what he needed to, That's how
I've never taken it that way, but maybe, it doesn't mean it.
The way I always took it was, that's right.
Yeah. And here's one more.
Here's one more.
Yeah, that's the way I've always interpreted it.
They are correct, but that was his. I mean, once he got the one more, don't overthink. He, that was enlightenment.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that was his.
Maybe I overthought.
So your point being, anyway, that...
Well, with Ajahn Jeff and the subjectification, while he's talking about seeing maybe stuff that's really happening at that feeling point, like this creating a duality, and whereas you go through, it's after the line on thinking, so it's really...
Well, that's what I was going to say. Actually, there's a number of spots where Bhopatra is put in a causal thing.
Yeah,
this sutta, but this sutta is the only one which actually the Vitakka comes...
First,
there's places in this, just Nipata and Deepa Nikaya 21, where it's actually before it precedes thinking.
If you'd like information on that, Ajahn Jeff goes into that very same discussion in detail in other parts of this book. I wasn't going to necessarily read it out, but yeah, he compares the fact that this sutta Papancha appears where it does in relation to Vitakka, and it's different in other ones. And then he goes to explain why he thinks that is, that both are valid in their own context.
I think, too, when we look at the different ways that Paticca-samuppada sort of develops, it's a circular process, whereas Papancha happens, and then we think in that context, and it aggravates Papancha.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you get this loop of, however you want to call it, objectification or whatever, but I can see how when I call something like a person, a person is this way, and then I think about those qualities, I reinforce that objectification, and soon it solidifies it into itself.
Right.
And also, I'd also like to mention that the Buddha uses different words to talk about too much thinking.
Hmm.
In both Vitakka Santana Sutta and also the Dvaita Vitakka Sutta, he uses a different phrase. He uses atichiran anuvitakketi anuvichareti. So, like, there's three parts in that phrase, which means, like, too far, too much, overthinking, over pondering, maybe a translation.
Mm-hmm.
So, when he's talking about, like, excessive thinking, it's a problem, and he provides tools for it, but he also doesn't use the word papancha anywhere in those.
Mm-hmm.
He resorbs, pesorbs, resorbs.
Anguttara 9, 8. 8 Anguttara 8.
Anguttara 8, Sutta number.
I'm not going to be able to read everything.
Sutta number 30.
30.
Sorry.
I kind of figured this might stimulate some discussion.
A lot of ink has been spilled.
Yes. Concept in reality is one, if you're really interested.
And he derives that translation of papancha as proliferation from the root of the word, which is all good in its way. But in a talk I was listening on this subject, Ajahn Jesser points to that and says that's a way of doing it, but you can't always depend on the root of a word to indicate the way that it's used in context. He gives the example of the word terrific. If you look at the roots of the word terrific and use it,
terror, fear,
something that inspires fear,
mm.
and it's changed over time, mm. so now we use it to mean really good. Mm. It hasn't always meant that. Mm.
Anuruddha is, after he receives teaching from the Buddha, he spent that next residence right there at that place, and that's where he dwelling alone, withdrawn, heedful, ardent, resolute, in no long time realized for himself direct knowledge.
So not necessarily related.
Yeah, it wasn't a direct, it was obviously an important encouragement for Anuruddha prior to his practicing in solitude. But it wasn't put to listen to that teaching and then he was enlightened.
I could the rest of the sutta is a lot of repetition, so I could continue in a very abbreviated way to finish it off. And there's one paragraph with one phrase that I find I don't really understand the point of it, and I looked up for another translation and couldn't find the point of it. But and then one brief reading, or maybe a 5-minute reading from Analia, which would probably take us to about 7:15. Or we could close the books and try and pick this up again in a few days, or not. I'm not sure if it's too difficult to pick it up again.
I'd pick it up again.
You would?
Yeah.
Okay. Think people can remember where we're at? File it away?
Yeah.
Maybe I'll just do one more day or something.
Sure, sure.
Okay. Okay. I'll do it.
Annamaya Namagataya Sarukara Dadamase
Sadhu, sadhu.